or Clinton Arthur Jr., depending on which take on this you got. So, Ms. Ellenson,
okay.
We are ready whenever you are, and would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'll leave 15 minutes, if that's okay. Because I don't know how much I'm going to really have to say here, but okay, it's Clinton Arthur Jr., that is his name, and I had been his lawyer back before in 2007 when he had the robbery and firearm charge. And so,
Mr. Ellenson, this is Judge Frank. Let's see if we can get to the chase here.
Yes, sir.
Other than Old Chief, a United States Supreme Court case that deals with interpretation of the federal rules, Virginia law says basically that you lose.
No, but we have adopted 403. We have the federal rules now. We have the federal rules. So you brought it over.
What number is that?
403. Federal Rule of Evidence 403. I mean, let's see. And so, because once we had the case in Norfolk Circuit Court, Virginia had brought in all the federal rules. You've adopted them. Those are the rules now in the state. Those are the rules of evidence. And if they had wanted to do a 404B motion, they could have tried to do that. But, 403, that's the rule that applies. And that was what my argument was about. And that...
Can you speak a little louder, please?
Yes, sir. It's 403. But even at that point, I mean, it's the exact same rules, so that's why this does apply. They talk about in the... sort of the reason behind the rules in Old Chief, that the Commonwealth gets to tell their story and they get to decide how they want to prove their case. But if the fact what he was convicted of 8 years, 9 years ago doesn't have anything to do with the element of the offense, which is simply he is a convicted felon. Whether he's a convicted felon for, fishing, and that somehow that became a felony, it doesn't matter what the it has to be a violent felony. I admit that, but as long as it's a violent felony, that's all the jury needs to know. That's all the Commonwealth needs to have in its arsenal to prove as an element of the case, element of proof, and that's what they have. When you stipulate to it, then that's the end of it. And the only Boone didn't really reach it. Boone, in the Boone case, they just said that they couldn't do all five, but because the attorney, the plaintiff and the defendant in that case didn't, he wasn't willing to stipulate. He said that all you needed was one, but he was going to let him do it. So Boone doesn't really apply. So, yeah, Old Chief, I think, rules, and Old Chief controls. And that's why if the defendant offers to stipulate, the Commonwealth has to take the stipulation, and then the case is tried with that stipulation.
Well, let's assume that our rule mirrors Federal Rule 403. Are we bound by the Supreme Court's interpretation of our own rules when it doesn't involve constitutional issues?
Yes. Yes, because it's as if you've appealed. Yeah, because they're the sort of the super Virginia Supreme Court in that case. And that's what you have here. Since they didn't say in Old Chief that the Fifth or Sixth Amendment applies, that it's not necessarily a Fifth or Sixth Amendment type of an issue, or a due process issue, that is simply an evidentiary rule issue. I mean, you could appeal. Can you not appeal a state court decision to the U.S. Supreme Court? It would seem like yes, that their interpretation of the rules would be applicable to the state, to this state, because we adopted their rules of evidence.
This is Judge O'Brien. I had a question, a procedural question.
Yes, ma'am.
You objected during the Commonwealth's opening statement to the use of the prior conviction. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am, but I also, before we even got started, I raised it with the trial court.
In a pretrial?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then the court subsequently offered to give a jury instruction about the purpose of the conviction, but that you did not request that jury instruction. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. That is correct.
Okay. Does that make any difference to your position?
I don't think it does.
Okay.
I just thought that the rule was very clear from the U.S. Supreme Court, and I just assumed it would be applicable in Norfolk Circuit Court because I think we're operating under the same set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see the need to try to have a jury instruction on that.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Well, that's you know, either again, that's my position that Old Chief applies and it trumps it's controlling.
Thank you, Mr. Allison. You will have plenty of time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. First of all, I think it is unnecessary to decide the issue that the defendant has raised. Judge O'Brien has brought up what I think is the controlling circumstance, namely that the trial judge explicitly offered to give a cautionary instruction to remove any potential that the jury would regard proof of the prior convictions from 7 years earlier as prejudicial propensity evidence. The bottom line is the defense never took up the court on its offer. And under those circumstances, I think that there's no need to decide this issue. It's much like the Supreme Court of Virginia said in, I think it was the only footnote in Boone, that there was no need in that case to determine the impact of Old Chief on the earlier decision of this court in Glover, given the defendant's failure to offer to stipulate. It seems to me much the same could and should be said here. The failure to take the opportunity explicitly offered to give the jury a limiting instruction should require the affirmance of this conviction. If there was a problem with or a potential problem with the proof of the particulars of the prior convictions, then under many decisions of the Supreme Court of Virginia and this court, a cautionary instruction normally is deemed adequate to deal with that and to ensure that it doesn't taint the jury's verdict. You had in a case where a cautionary instruction was given, I've cited in my brief, the death penalty case in the Virginia Supreme Court Telegoose, and there was a concern there that certain evidence might lead the jury to think the defendant was a member of the Russian mafia, which strikes me as at least as potentially, given the reference and given the nature of the charges, at least as problematical as anything that occurred here. But the Supreme Court of Virginia said the submission of the cautionary instruction was deemed sufficient to ensure that the jury properly considered the evidence. Only if you can show a manifest probability that even if a cautionary instruction is given, that there's still too much of a potential for prejudice, is there any basis for reversing? I think clearly there's not such a manifest probability here. So there's simply no need to even decide the issue given the defendant's failure to take up the court on the opportunity to give the jury a cautionary instruction. I would point out, by the way, that in the Old Chief case, the dissent, and it was a dissent, it was a 5-4 vote, the dissent pointed out that any incremental harm in that case could be properly mitigated by cautionary instructions. The majority in that case said nothing one way or the other about cautionary instructions, and that was one problem that the dissent identified in the majority opinion. But the only members of that court that said anything one way or the other about cautionary instructions were the four dissenters who said that that should normally take care of the matter. Now, Old Chief is plainly not based on any constitutional imperative, so I don't think under any circumstances it's a matter of controlling this court. It's certainly to the extent that the defendant can argue that the reasoning and result of the U.S. Supreme Court is consistent with his own argument, then obviously he can assert that that is persuasive authority. But I've cited several cases on brief from elsewhere saying that Old Chief is not binding, and I would disagree. Even though you now have the federal rules of evidence, at least in part, now becoming the Virginia rules of evidence, I don't think that any decision of the United States Supreme Court construing the federal rules of evidence, which is by definition a non-constitutional ruling, is controlling as such on the state appellate courts in Virginia. Another way, counsel talked about being able to appeal any ruling of the Supreme Court of Virginia to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, to the extent it's certainly well established that the state court, that the state Supreme Court of any jurisdiction is the ultimate arbiter of state law. And I think if the Virginia Supreme Court held under Rule 2:403 of the Virginia Rules of Evidence that the rule meant this or didn't mean that, I think that would be binding on the U.S. Supreme Court. But again, there's simply no need to decide the issue given the opportunity to have given the jury cautionary instruction, which the defense declined to do. I've said this on brief, and I think, in effect, if there was a problem absent a cautionary instruction with the evidence, and the defendant chose not to rectify or alleviate the matter, then that is very much the equivalent of invited error. You can't, if you have some vehicle adequate for your purposes to eliminate any potential harm, and you knowingly choose not to avail yourself of that opportunity, then you're not properly in a position on appeal to complain about how things worked out. I would also point out, in terms of the cautionary instruction and in terms of the impact on the jury of this evidence, there's one important distinction between the present case and the statute under which I've said Clinton in my brief, I'll just say the defendant, was convicted, and Old Chief is this. In the case at bar, the defendant was indicted for and convicted of possession of a firearm by an ex-felon previously convicted of a violent felony, not just a felony, a violent felony. In Old Chief, is just simply an offense for which the defendant would receive more than 1 year. I mean, if the jury in the case at bar knew that even by way of a stipulation that the defendant was convicted of a quote-unquote violent felony, I submit that there's simply not that much ground that is covered between that and the proof of the particulars of what the violent felony might have been. I would submit that as I think the questions have indicated, the prior Virginia case law pretty plainly is against the defendant. I would argue that Old Chief does not require this court to set aside those uniform decisions. That would leave the final question, and again, this goes very much as well to the issue of whether there's a manifest probability that a cautionary instruction would have been inadequate, which is the issue of harmless error. There are only two elements in this case: one, possession of the gun, and two, proof of the prior violent felony. The only one that was litigated at trial was the possession element, and there's no question as to the existence of the other element. The only question has been how could that properly be established on the record. As to the possession, it's plainly reviewable under the standard governing non-constitutional error, the very fact that Old Chief founded its decision on the federal rules of evidence indicates that, and I would submit that any claimed error here was harmless. You have the defendant's repeated statements in the minutes after he shot himself that that's exactly what he'd done. He'd shot himself, which, of course, if that's true, that by extension means that he was illegally possessing the firearm. And he said it both to the investigating police officer and to an EMT. And these are akin to excited utterances, which, of course, are admissible under the hearsay rule where they otherwise would not be because there are indicia of reliability. You say something in the heat of the moment, and it's deemed to be that much more reliable. I would submit the same thing here. Plus, the defendant's mother's testimony makes it exceedingly improbable that anyone other than the defendant himself could have shot himself. They were in her bedroom. She doesn't say a word about anyone else being there. And he says, oh, I've shot. I think she said that he said he'd shot himself. She certainly reports that when the 911 call is made. The defendant, 6 weeks later, once his passions have cooled and he's somewhat more aware of the potential legal predicament he's in, talks with an officer. He gives, by my count, five separate versions of what happened, the final one of which indicated that he'd accidentally shot himself, but of course that also showed he possessed the gun, and at that point he's taken to the magistrate's office. He explained to the officer at that time the contradictory accounts by saying he'd just been released. He knew he had 10 years hanging over him. So when you put all that together, I think it's overwhelming proof that he illegally possessed the firearm, which again was the only contested element at trial. So even if the defendant's reliance on Old Chief otherwise were well taken, any error here would be harmless under the governing standard of review. I would point out that the U.S. Supreme Court and Old Chief specifically noted it was not addressing any harmless error issue. If the court were ever to get to it in this case, I submit that the harmlessness of any error is apparent. So again, I submit the court need not decide the issue actually advanced by the defendant given his failure to take up the court on its offer to give a cautionary instruction that Old Chief is not binding. And after all, Old Chief simply said in that case that there was an abuse of discretion. It's not as if it's established some particular rule. So that would be an odd case to be binding on another court to begin with. And finally, for the reasons I've articulated, that any claimed error was harmless. So for those reasons, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I appreciate
Thank you.
Your... And Mr. Ellison, you've got some time for rebuttal if you'd like to offer any.
Okay, just briefly, then, a couple of things. The you know, I didn't take the jury instruction offer because I just thought it was sort of, I wasn't trying to invite any error or anything like that. It was just, I thought it was just the law. I thought it was the rule that if you stipulate, then the Commonwealth cannot introduce it. I can just, and I, you know, anecdotally, all the cases I try in federal court, it's just a rule that we always stipulate, and it's just a given, and frankly, I was quite surprised when I tried this case in state court, and Judge Hall said, nope, that's not what we do here. So that was sort of the basis for me even doing it. I wasn't even sure there was Old Chief, honestly. It was just a practice on my part that's just the way things go. I just thought that any kind of firearm convicted felon, they always just stipulate. So I guess I think it is a rule that it is sort of just the rules in federal court. So I guess my thought would be that if the case goes up to the Virginia Supreme Court and it's ruled negatively against me, then if I have a right to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, then it would seem like that would be controlling. But if what Mr. Anderson's saying is correct, that it just doesn't that the Virginia Supreme Court is the final decision maker on this, then I guess I would just lose. So I guess I'll just leave it with that.
All right, Ms. Ellison, thank you very much.
Okay.
Now submitted, and we will get back with you all before too terribly long.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.